Thank you, Sarah. If I had been a little bit younger, I would have blushed. I don't think I deserve all the things you said. So as Sarah made clear, I don't know much about anything. I hope I will provide evidence of this today as well. Just a few introductory words about what doesn't appear in the ad for the lecture and about the piece. I was very uncertain about what I should be talking about at the Lauterbach Center. They kind of invited me, they left me wide measure of discretion about selecting a topic. And then I decided to go for this, and I felt uncomfortable about it because it's the very first time that I speak about something that I have already published. Books are different, you're left with a wide margin of maneuvering because you can play, with different parts. But this was an article that I had already published, and it's tricky because what you had to say, you already said it. And you wrote it, so it's there for everyone to be seen. And probably you wrote it at the best of your skills and capabilities, so you can only do words. But I decided to take this nonetheless, and I wanted to tell you why I got into this. And I'm afraid that the explanation is very peculiar, because it's true what I say at some point, that I had bumped into this very strange collection of essays and extravaganza by Isaac Disraeli, a man of literature of the 19th century, most famous for being the father of the British Prime Minister by the same name. And I had this photocopy, this short essay on Cause and Pretext. Cause and Pretext. And I started playing with this idea, and I realized that was exactly why I had just accepted to participate in the symposium of the Journal of International Dispute Settlement in which this particular article was written. Because the symposium was about Shakespeare and the loop. And then I realized that I had accepted because I needed the pretext to say something that I wanted to say, which was not really about Shakespeare, I needed the pretext. And in this writing, Isaac Disraeli makes this difference between pretext, which is the ostensible cause for doing something, and the real cause, the concealed cause. And that's how I started playing in my head. It's not that I was not interested in Shakespeare and Law. I had read with enormous interest Quentin Skinner's Forensic Shakespeare, which I thought it was jolly good. I'm not an expert, but I thought that this idea that a historian discovers that all that Shakespeare knew or might have known about Law might have come from grammar school, because in grammar schools back at that time, judicial rhetoric was part of the subjects that were actually taught. So the fact that we had for a long time interpreted the Merchant of Venice in the sense of the confrontation between equity and the strict application of the law might in fact have been a little bit off the mark, because in fact what this was about was a confrontation between what qualified at the time as a juridical constitution, which means a dispute about what's right and wrong, and what was an issue of interpretation of the text, which was the bond invoked by Shylock before the court. So I think that was interesting because it reversed the perspective of a long-established interpretation of a well-known play. But in fact, I accepted to write about Shakespeare because I did want to say something about storytelling and rhetoric. So after having paid my dues, I realized that this was not really the first time that I had used the pretext for another cause. And that had happened also in the field of literature. For instance, when I participated, and I did it with affection in memory of our beloved mentor at Harvard Law School, the volume that Michael edited in honor of Death of Bax, and I wrote about interpretation. And there too, I realized it wasn't quite in keeping with the title, How to Make Translational Law Work, because I wrote an essay on interpretation generally. So, but I needed a pretext to say that, and I found it there. Sorry, Michael, it was not instrumental, but it was also a sign of affection towards the words Death of. And there too, I had been intrigued by something that had to do with literature, and that was the notion of interpretive community that I and others borrowed from literary theory. And then there was an even more stunning example in which the ostensible and the concealed causes did not really match. And I was reminded that in 2009 I had made the opening lecture at the Academy of International Humanitarian Law and Human Rights in Geneva. And there, I purposefully, I was invited to talk about terrorism and international armed conflict. And then I added this qualification, a law and literature perspective, because I thought that literature could be aptly used in that context, and that was the real cause, to this venomous attitude of conceiving law merely as technique, as a set of rules. And I had been shocked, I still remember vividly, that I had listened to a colleague who was explaining to an audience what a proportionality in attack was, and it took 25 minutes to explain this to the audience. And I thought to myself, if you need 25 minutes to explain what a proportionality in attack is, there must be something profoundly wrong about the way in which we've come to think about IHL. This is something that a commander on the field has a fraction of a second to decide, so it can't take 25 minutes. And I remember that I tried to inject into that lecture some humane element that would remind international maritime lawyers about what this is about. It's about death, it's about wounds, it's about blood, maiming, bereaved persons, hatred, madness, fear, fury, angst, vomit, urine, stench, disease, annihilation, death again. And then again, I made a link to literature and law, and I went back to a reading I had done about Robert Cover's well-known essay on violence and the word, in which he says that legal interpretation takes place in a field of pain and death. And interpretations in law also constitute justifications for violence, which has already occurred or which is about to occur. And when interpreters have finished their work, they frequently leave behind victims whose lives have been torn apart by those organized social practices of violence. And I thought, it meant so much, it was so deep, and it went so deep, and it cut so deep, that at the end, I remember the students applauded for a long time. And I'm not saying this to boost my ego, it doesn't need any boosting. But I noticed that my colleagues in the first rows were not clapping at all. And the students were. And I thought that it must have been some sort of an act of liberation for them to be able to reconnect again with the humanity that underlies law and its world. So these are the precedents, so to speak, to make it sound a little bit more legal. But what were these precedents? I like to qualify them as, and I'm borrowing from Peter Brook and Paul Gilbert's laws of stories, narrative and rhetoric in law, I like to qualify them as encounters. I just encountered literature, and I thought it might be useful to understand what I was doing, what we are doing. And then after these encounters, you go back. But you will have changed after the encounter, just as much as you change after having made an important human encounter in your life. And then you reintegrate your disciplinary solitude, perhaps with more tools, with more insights, with more analogies, more devices to open up perspectives to feel a little bit more free. But why does one need a pretext to speak about law and literature? Well, let's be frank, because there is a great deal of aversion towards literature. It's endemic in the field. You say to a lawyer that literature is important, they would raise their eyebrows if they are polite, otherwise you'd get insulted. There are reasons for this. The preoccupation that we always have about the autonomy of the law, and anybody who is involved in any kind of interdisciplinary endeavor knows damn well that this is always the underlying tension. You are perceived, or even you perceive yourself as somebody who might actually abandon the field. You don't have an identity anymore, and when you start playing with all of this, empirical studies, law and economics, international relations, law and literature. So what's left with the autonomy of the law? What kind of claim can we lay anymore that what we do is different from international relations theorists, from writers, and so on and so forth? And as you may know, this has been also cause for some people to write extensively about it. Richard Posner, most noticeably, has devoted an enormous part of his life to writing against literature. Still don't understand how can you possibly spend so much time speaking against something that you can't stand. It's an enormous investment. So, his book about law and literature, Misunderstood Relationship, which I think is closer to the third edition, I'm not sure. You know, he sees literature as remote from law, which he sees as a technique of government, as a set of authoritative declarations by politically authorized sources to be analyzed on the basis of deductive logic. But then, after 450 pages, he acknowledges that the legal curriculum might benefit from, you know, including compulsory courses on interpretation, on the use of literary techniques, on legal writing, on the claimed humanizing effects of literature or law. So what are the 450 pages before about? I don't know. But, you know, it's quite telling because Richard Posner epitomizes the homo economicus. So the very trendy thing to do nowadays, the idea that we're all driven by the preoccupation of maximizing our personal profit, that we're all rational human beings that act rationally to pursue our own personal gain. So there is little space for literature in this world anymore. Humanities are often vilified. They are often looked down at. And if we do deal with them, and with literature in particular, we only deal with superficial things, for instance with style. Wow, style is it's a chapter on its own. I think it's important, style, isn't it? To be aware that we have a style when we write. But this is difficult to be in, to be aware of in the lawyerly world. I remember a former assistant of mine brought to my attention an article which I'm sure you are familiar with, Fred Rodell, Goodbye to Law Reviews. Have a look at that. It's an extraordinary account of a Yale professor writing against law reviews. And they say, well, he said in this article that there are two things that are wrong about legal writing, substance and style. A penny worth of content and a penny worth of content concealed beneath a pound of style. Long-winded, convoluted sentences, hard constructions, endless series of redundant footnotes, and all of that being said with an air of great importance. Never a firm stance, never somebody who says, oh, come on, the court got it wrong, what a bunch of idiots. No, you would say it's not unreasonable to speculate that among the options that the court might have taken, this definitely sounds as the most reasonable one. And the extraordinary thing about this is that this article was written and my assistant had redacted the real publication in 1936, and has not changed ever since. No, I mean, I could just think of what we get published in the reviews these days. And, you know, we have this indirect and impersonal style, which is a standard rule. Journals, occasionally even publishing companies, you know, force us to standardize our language, to use a language which is perceived to be in conformity with the protocol of the discipline, something that can be sold. It's a lot of pressure. As you know, Pierre Schlag used to say, thinking about a lawyer implies a certain mindset. You know, the law is supposed to be formal, universal, neutral, and personal. So we are taught to think formally, universally, neutrally, and impersonally. So sometimes we are even deprived of our own self. And I think that style is a way of asserting our own self, who we are as scholars, as students, as people who think about internationally. Occasionally, there is a tension to style. Cardoso, in his 1925 Law and Literature article, devoted attention to the style of judgments. and you distinguish between different categories. And I'm quoting the type magisterial or imperative, the type coercive or sententious, the type conversational or homely, the style demonstrative or persuasive, the style tonsorial or agglutinative. I'm not sure that even the native speakers are familiar with this kind of terminology. But the point he made is that style and substance are indissolubly linked. But so if the bond between law and literature is not style, what is this about? And I think that the link between law and literature is about the centrality of language and text. And however distinct the two disciplines, they both are taken up with text and its interpretation. They both create and rely on symbols and myths. They both use rhetoric in a constitutive fashion. And they shape reality through language. Law can be seen as a linguistic and cultural practice in the social community in which it operates. It constitutes shared community values. And I think that both literary and legal texts equally contribute in a fundamental way to constituting that community in which we live and in conveying its cultural and moral traditions. James Boyd White, writing his famous book on the legal imagination in 1973, he defined law as language rather than a set of rules. And every text is written in language, and the language always entails commitments to views of the world. I think this is a powerful message for us to reflect upon, and inevitably that connects me to a well-known passage that I'm sure many of you might be familiar with. And this is Robert Cover's Nomos and Narrative. Let me quote briefly from it. Robert Cover wrote, "We inhabit a nomos, a normative universe. We constantly create and maintain a world of right and wrong, lawful and unlawful, valid and void. The rules and principles of justice, the formal institutions of the law, and the conventions of a social order are important, but they are a small part of the normative universe we inhabit. No set of legal institutions or prescriptions exist apart from the narratives that locate it and give it meaning. For every constitution, there is an epic, for each decalogue, a scripture. Once understood in the context of the narratives that give it meaning, law becomes not merely a system of rules to be observed, but a world in which we live. In this normative world, law and narrative are inseparably related." This was something that I found very inspiring. And if one gets carried away by this idea that we inhabit this normative world in which law and narrative are inseparably related, why not break in the ultimate taboo? Thinking of judgments, not as holy writs, as Sir Robert Jennings once qualified them, but as texts. As, you know, like any other text. And maybe as stories as well. We all tell stories when we do legal work. If you are a counsel arguing a case before a court, you tell a story to the court, and you hope to persuade the court to do something, not to do something. We academics, scholars, our students, we notoriously tell stories all the time. We try to communicate something. And why not judges? Regardless of the formal authority that is vested with any court, also judges have an interest to tell a story which be convincing, which be persuasive to the audience that they address. And that's why I talk in this article about storytelling, because there is plenty of things that you can draw from literature and analysis of text as if you were studying a literary text and a story. You can develop an idea of perspectivism to look at the same set of facts, the same case from different perspectives. I found it very inspiring to read this novel by Ian Pearce, An Instance of the Finger Post, a thriller which was set in Oxford, 17th century Oxford, a story of the martyr told by four different protagonists. And the stories were completely different. So you had the impression that you were listening to people who had to tell you a different story, but in fact it was the same mother, looked from different perspectives. And it made me think of, I don't know, of the separate and dissenting opinions in Arrest Warrant, where Bergenthal, Higgins and Coymans took a completely different perspective to what the majority of the court took in terms of the jurisdictional immunities of foreign states' organs. It's a little bit like that. It's different perspectives. Or the idea that you need to be a reliable narrator if you want to be persuasive, if you want to be trusted by the audience. And there are some stunning examples in which, for instance, the International Court of Justice has not been a reliable narrator, in which the story it told us was not really convincing. And I expound this on other texts. I think I used two examples, the arrest warrant and these are Ellie Wall's advisory opinion. So there is plenty of things that I think one can draw upon to make a link between literary and legal text. But there is one insight that I think is very useful for us to consider, and that is that whoever speaks does so for an audience. I have you as audience today. I have, you know, students. Sarah has an audience at any time that she teaches, but also judges have audiences. They also speak to audiences, even if we don't want to admit it. And I think to explore the interrelationship between the speaker and audience is extremely useful to understand what's going on. And there is always an interrelationship between the speaker and the audience. I wrote on this in a few years ago, and that was an analysis of the jurisdictional immunities of the state case. And I decided to look at it from the perspective of the rhetorical structure of the judgment, which was indeed well written, but also looking at what kind of audience did they address when they said what they said. And probably the majority of the judges thought that they were addressing an audience which is still made up states. So they wanted to reassure these states, they wanted to talk to them. And Yusuf and Cansado had another kind of audience. They spoke a different language and they addressed probably the constituency of human rights lawyers, activists, and that kind of... And I think it's very important because it provides insights on how the mindset of the judge is, on what kind of instruments they use, and how they talk to people and to audiences. And another strand of investigation that I briefly explore is also the kind of rhetorical techniques that are used in judgments. Inductive logic, this sense of shared rationality as a justification for judgment. Something that is always very appreciated in legal reasoning is that which goes without saying, so that you can make any opponent ridiculous if he or she were to argue the contrary. Recourse to legal presumptions. The deployment of the general rule versus exception construction, which reverts the burden of proof, very effective. These techniques are part of the lawyer's ability and also the judge's ability. And good judges, good lawyers, they have all of these in their toolbox and they use it regularly, even if we don't pay attention to it. But why is it, and that's an important question, why is it that we don't pay much attention to it? Because rhetoric has always been vilified for centuries. And at least since Descartes and the Enlightenment, rhetoric is invariably associated with a shallow form of thought and knowledge. It's not about knowledge itself. And yet, rhetoric has an ancient tradition in ancient Greece. Sophists, Plato, Aristotle, in Rome with Quintilian and Cicero. But to see it back on stage, we had to wait the 1960s and 70s, and in law, I think that the work of Cheyenne Perelman, this Belgian philosopher, has been absolutely fundamental to restore rhetoric to its dignity. And Ian Scobie, who's the one that I think has gone in depth in this, recently wrote that rhetorical argument takes the form of an exercise in practical reason, and legal argumentation is a specialized form of rhetoric that aims to practical results. It does not want to find the truth, but it aims to persuade. And to think in this way, as rhetoric as a form of practical reasoning, I think it may reinstate rhetoric to its long-forgotten dignity, and it may make us more aware of the importance of mastering this kind of tools. And I think rhetoric can be a useful instrument to spur also our creativity. And if you think of what Cicero called the ars inveniendi, so the creative moment in which you think about what kind of arguments I can use in this context. And that's where I think that the mastery of these instruments and these techniques can come in handy to any kind of legal professional, including a judge's. Okay, so to conclude, does it mean that writing judgments is like writing literature? Most lawyers, that's the kind of objection they would immediately raise, right? Which, interestingly, is a rhetorical technique, because you make a caricature of your opponent's claim, and you ridicule it. So you win. And of course, that's not the message. It never occurred to me that writing judgments and writing literature is one and the same thing. Legal writing is a constrained exercise. And a good professional knows what these constraints are. Legal storytelling is narrative within a culture of argument, as Boyd White puts it. It's a way of structuring the legal argument and to provide argument with more persuasive thoughts. It cannot make up for the lack of good and legally plausible arguments, but to know how to weave a narrative thread, I think, is an advantage for any legal professional. And also for judges, to establish their authority, their credibility and prestige, because they all aim at that, regardless of the formal authority which is vested in them. And their ability to persuade the audiences that they address depends precisely on the extent to which they master also these techniques. So you may remember that at the outset I made reference to what I qualified as encounters. And I would like to finish on this note. Rhetoric would have it that at the end I need to rely on some big legal authority, but I'd rather rely on French actress Juliette Binoche. Wonderful performer, beautiful and elegant lady, intelligent person. And when asked in one of these silly showbiz-like interviews, you know, what is your ambition after having won all these prizes, all this money? And she responded, my ambition is not to make money, is to have beautiful encounters. And, you know, paraphrasing Juliette Binoche's answer, I would go the same way and say, for me this has been a way of making a beautiful encounter. I did not say what I told you to convince you about something that you have to do or that you have to believe in, but I wanted you to share the reason why this encounter has been beautiful to me. Thank you for listening.